This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Opposition officials in Zimbabwe say several activists were either abducted or arrested Friday ahead of a planned protest over the introduction of controversial bond notes.
That's Sebastian Mofu reporting from Harare. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, a dramatic upsurge has taken place in the number of migrant deaths on the Mediterranean Sea crossing between Libya and the Italian island of Lampedusa. UN agencies say 850,000 people in southern Madagascar are in urgent need of humanitarian aid. And the International Criminal Court fears more African countries could withdraw from it. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, opposition officials in Zimbabwe say several activists were either abducted or arrested today ahead of a planned protest over the introduction of controversial bond notes. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare for VOA News.
By late Friday, some activists could not be located. Police moved in large numbers to the venue of the protest against the bond notes President Robert Mugabe's government wants to introduce this month to ease the country's cash shortages. Two vehicles were banned early Friday that were carrying activists coordinating the protest. Patterson Zamara, an activist who was abducted and later released, said the assailants took him into their vehicle and later dropped him naked in some bushes after assaulting him. Speaking on his hospital bed to reporters, he said he suspected state security agents were behind the incident.
It wasn't an easy and palatable experience. However, I'm not at all discouraged by what happened today. That's not going to deter and discourage me from fighting for a better Zimbabwe. I can sacrifice all those things for as long as it's for a better Zimbabwe. I know that one day we're going to welcome a new and better Zimbabwe, and these are some of the prices we're having to pay.
Zimbabwe's political opposition accused the Mugabe government of failing to end corruption and the abuse of human rights. Opposition leaders say the central bank's introduction of the new bond notes will not deal with such issues, but will instead plunge the nation back to the days of hyperinflation and shortages when Zimbabwe's currency became essentially worthless. Zimbabwe abandoned its currency in February 2009 amid hyperinflation. Since then, it has been using all major currencies, but mostly the US dollar. The government says the new bond notes, which will trade at par with the US dollar, would ease cash shortages and stop smuggling of foreign currencies out of the country. The government has since said it will go ahead with introducing bond notes despite threats of protests like the one which had been set for this Friday. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
A dramatic upsurge has taken place in the number of migrant deaths, mainly from West Africa, on the perilous Mediterranean Sea crossing between Libya and the Italian island of Lampedusa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration reports at least 365 people have disappeared and are presumed dead after at least six incidents in the Mediterranean in the past 3 days. It says that brings the number of migrant deaths in the Mediterranean this year to a record 4,636. IOM spokesman Lena Doyle calls this a calamity in plain sight.
In November, we have 365 deaths that we've counted. So this is six times higher than the deaths last year in that month. Overall, we're counting 1,000 more migrant deaths in the Mediterranean compared to the same period last year. So over the stretch of the year, from January to November, 1,000 extra deaths and six times more in November alone.
Doyle says deaths on the Mediterranean are surging because the migrants are making the dangerous sea crossing in poor weather and rough conditions. Survivors say smugglers are forcing migrants to get on board unsafe rubber dinghies, which take on water and gradually sink.
Migrants assuming and paying in the hope and expectation that they'll get a decent passage across the Mediterranean, coming down to the beach and being confronted with a rubber raft, and not having any options, sometimes physical restraints on them, even going back. So the situation is clearly alarming.
Doyle says there are few happy endings for migrants who survive the arduous journey and arrive safely in Italy. He tells VOA their expectations of having a good life in Europe and sending money home to their families is rarely realized. He says most of the requests for asylum from migrants who come from Gambia, Nigeria, Senegal, Mali, and elsewhere in West Africa are rejected. Doyle says they are regarded as economic migrants and are either deported or forced to live underground in the European Union. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
UN agencies say 850,000 people in southern Madagascar are in urgent need of humanitarian aid due to drought, locusts, and political instability. Efforts are underway to help farmers get ready for the planting season, which begins in December. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization warn food insecurity will worsen unless quick action is taken. David Orr is WFP's regional spokesperson based in Johannesburg.
It's extremely bad. You've got more than a million people in the south who are food insecure, who really don't know where their next meal is coming from. And of those 850,000 people in acute food insecurity, and that really means having no regular or guaranteed access to food.
He says women are desperate to feed their kids.
When we were there, we saw mothers feeding their babies fruit of red cactus plants. This red cactus grows by the side of the road. And that was how desperate they were. They just had nothing else to give their children.
Madagascar has suffered from the effects of the recent El Nino weather cycle that brought severe drought to southern Africa.
Madagascar actually had three successive years of drought. Particularly the south of the island has been very, very badly hit, not only by drought, but also by everything from plagues of locusts in recent years to marginalization. It's very remote from the rest of the country. The infrastructure has been allowed to fall into disrepair over many years. The roads were just appalling in the south.
Without good roads, farmers cannot transport their crops to market, and political instability in recent years has worsened food insecurity through what Orr calls economic stagnation. The World Food Program is providing food aid in Madagascar, but it's also working with the Food and Agriculture Organization to help farmers.
As from next month, FAO is going to start distributing cuttings and seeds to the farmers. And we are going to be giving complementary rations to these same farming households, basically so that they don't eat the seeds, that farmers really are so desperate to feed their families that they've resorted to eating their seeds. This must not happen. This is the planting season. This is a small window of opportunity between now and January.
The FAO is handing out tools and drought-tolerant cassava and sweet potato seeds. They produce plants which quickly mature. However, UN agencies say once again, money is an issue. The FAO says it needs $22 million, but only has received $4.5 million for the project. And the WFP says it's received $30 million for its drought relief operation in southern Madagascar. That runs until March, but the agency says it's facing a $50 million shortfall. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 15 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Several activists were either abducted or arrested today in Zimbabwe ahead of a planned protest over the introduction of controversial bond notes. A dramatic upsurge has taken place in the number of migrant deaths, mainly from West Africa, on the perilous Mediterranean Sea crossing between Libya and the island of Lampedusa. And UN agencies say 850,000 people in southern Madagascar are in urgent need of humanitarian aid due to drought, locusts, and political instability. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has been rocked by a series of withdrawals by African countries that were original signatories to the Rome Statute that established the court. This week, Russia also pulled its signature from the ICC treaty, and the Philippines could follow. Henry Ridgewell reports that the court could be facing a domino effect of countries quitting its jurisdiction.
Three African states, Burundi, South Africa, and Gambia, signal their intention to quit the International Criminal Court this year, claiming the court disproportionately targets African leaders. Phil Clark is from the London University School of Oriental and African Studies.
There's a real concern right across Africa about the meddling of international actors in African affairs.
Russian President Vladimir Putin removed his country's signature from the founding treaty this week, though it had never ratified its membership. His Philippine counterpart said Thursday he might follow Moscow's lead, claiming that, in his words, only the small ones like us are battered. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda this week defended the court's actions.
As an international community, we should be more concerned about ensuring accountability and justice for these very serious atrocity crimes.
While some African countries plan to quit, others have engaged more directly with the ICC, says analyst Phil Clark.
Countries like Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo have in fact seen the ICC as a tool that they can use against their military and political opponents. Nigeria is also engaging in discussions with the ICC prosecutor at the moment about potentially opening investigations into crimes committed by Boko Haram.
The ICC is opening its first major investigations outside Africa, looking into potential war crimes in the 2008 Russia-Georgia conflict. It has also begun looking into torture allegations against US and British forces in Afghanistan.
Those, I think, are very important cases because it would enable the court to say, look, we're not just picking on African states, we're also willing to tackle the biggest powers in the world.
But as the United States is not a signatory to the court, any successful prosecution appears unlikely. And analysts say the series of member state withdrawals raises the prospect the ICC will no longer be seen as an institution of global justice. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Well, during his election campaign, President-elect Donald Trump accused the Obama administration of spreading chaos in the Middle East and failing to uproot terrorist groups like ISIS. James Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute, spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi about the uncertain direction of the Trump foreign policy, especially toward the Middle East.
This is one of the big question marks that I think all of us have. I don't think anyone has an idea what Trump foreign policy would look like. There are only two issues on which he's been consistent in expressing his views. One has been his support for Russia's Putin, both in Ukraine, but also in Eastern Europe and in Syria. And then on Israel, after an initial comment about being neutral to negotiate, he's left most of the public discourse to his son-in-law and his legal advisor, Greenblatt, and they've come out with very, very tough, hardline pro-Netanyahu statements. So I don't really know what the rest of his policy would be like, or even if we can count on the policies that he's articulated on Russia and on Israel being consistent with the policies he'd put into place. I think he's a blank slate, unpredictable, and I frankly don't have any idea what he'll do or how to project it into the future.
Congress did override President Obama's veto on the controversial JASTA law. How do you think Mr. Trump would handle this issue, which would create trouble with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states?
I think that we may be in for a fix of the JASTA law before Donald Trump actually becomes president. That's what leading members of Congress appear ready to do in this lame duck session. And my hope is that the issue will be behind us before Inauguration Day.
Would a Republican president supported by majority Republican Congress give Mr. Trump a free hand to go beyond the traditional parameters of U.S. policy in the Middle East?
It depends on what issue, but I don't think that he will have a free hand on most issues, because Democrats will have enough to create both a block in terms of filibustering and delaying legislation, put holds on legislation. And they also, I think, will be a check to unlimited power, number one. Number two, I don't think we have any idea what Donald Trump stands for, what he believes in, or what he'll do. That's part of the danger of the man. And thirdly, one thing we've learned over the last several decades is that even if the president has an agenda, and in this case I don't think he has one, as I said, with the exception of his positions on Putin, which have been consistently supportive, even if he has a broader agenda, the world always has a way of kicking back. And so we measure presidents not by the agenda they set, but by the agenda that the world sets for them and how they react to it. None of us have any idea, come January, if Donald Trump is inaugurated, what the world will look like, what the world's reaction will be, what limits will be placed on his freedom of movement by the reactions of the world, and therefore what reactions occur here in the United States to policies he may propose. So I think that we're really entering uncharted waters right here, and I frankly have no idea where we're heading. That's one of the reasons why this is so dangerous.
That was James Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy. Well, while many think of refugees as a drag on a nation's economy, a United Nations World Food Program report out of Uganda says that giving cash and land assistance to refugees actually boosts the local economy. However, development economists warn that without including a financial education, the program's successes could be temporary. Elizabeth Pala reports from Kampala.
In Uganda, there's been a surge in South Sudanese refugees since violence broke out in Juba last July. With over 500,000 South Sudanese refugees in settlements and more crossing the border every day, relief agencies are looking for innovative ways to care for their refugees. And one method, cash assistance, has gotten a recent boost. A study conducted jointly by the University of California, Davis, the International Food Policy Research Institute, and the UN World Food Program found that not only did cash assistance reduce the overhead expenses of buying and shipping goods, it also had a multiplying effect on the national economy. Jaco Valli with the World Food Program explains.
The theory is this, that once refugee households are given food or cash, they will go to the local markets and buy goods, or sometimes even services. So these goods and services are provided by additional households who receive then the cash, and then the cash starts basically moving around and multiplying because the demand is driven in the local market.
Valli points out that Uganda's generous land policy towards refugees, under which refugee families get a small plot of cultivatable land, also stimulates the local market.
But in Ugandan context, the government also enabling the refugees to, particularly in the agriculture sector, by giving them a plot of land and then enabling refugees to cultivate and harvest crops. And these crops, they are not only utilizing for feeding themselves, they also use it to sell outside, which again contributes into the trade and contributes into this called multiplying effect of the assistance.
The cash assistance program currently enrolls 100,000 refugees and is set to double that amount by next March. However, it's a move that development economist Nzetse Were says must come with a solid financial education. Otherwise, they risk creating dependency.
They should encourage refugees to develop some sort of either savings plan or plan to use some of the money that they've been given to create a means of earning their own living. If those are not there, then it's just going to create a cycle of dependency. If they're just giving cash with no stipulation, if they're not doing any of that, they're just making thousands of people dependent on them, who will be worse off. Because they're getting that money, they don't see a reason, or there is no reason for them to develop their own sources of income.
The World Food Programme says that while there are no restrictions on cash assistance, they do give basic financial advice and find that refugees overwhelmingly spend their money buying food for their families. Representatives say that although the programme must be monitored and adaptable to changing landscapes, they have high hopes that it will show success in the coming years. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
And in other news around the continent, suicide bombers staged a series of attacks today in northeastern Nigeria, killing four of themselves and two civilian defense fighters, police said. In the early morning, police challenged two women and a man running toward a checkpoint opposite the Federal High Court in Maiduguri, said Victor Isuku, a police spokesman for the northeastern state of Borno. One woman set off her device, killing herself and the male accomplice, he said, while the other woman survived and was being questioned. Authorities also say two other suicide bombers blew themselves up at a bus and a taxi station on the outskirts of the city, killing themselves and the two civilian fighters. This marked the fifth attack in 3 weeks on the city that is the birthplace of Nigeria's homegrown Islamic extremist group, Boko Haram. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdulrahman, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one not JJ, this one not JJ.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.